of Design at NC State, and I've asked him a couple of questions, and he's going to respond to them.
I decided that I wanted to be an architect very early in my life. In the seventh grade, are you getting a recording there? Partially for the wrong reason. A course was introduced into my grade school in Sioux City, Iowa. The Hunt School in Sioux City, Iowa, which, by the way, is the same school where Abigail Van Buren and her sister, what's the other name?
Ann Landers.
Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren went to the same school with the same superintendent. They're younger than I am, of course, so they were there long after I was there. But the Hunt School was a good graded school, and in the seventh grade, that was before the days of the junior high school, a course in architectural drawing was introduced, and I liked it, and so I got a summer job for $3-4 a week in an architect's office that summer, and I worked every summer between school after that in architect's offices. My father was a Methodist minister, and he was trained for public school work, and when I was born, he was superintendent of schools in a little town called Otto, Iowa, and he was getting a salary of $800 a year at that time. And when I was 17 months old, he got the call to go into the ministry, and he became a Methodist minister at a salary of $400 a year. And of course, the family got a parsonage, a house. My mother said it was probably worth about $7 a month. We had a privy in the backyard, and the water was in the backyard with a pump. Lighting was by kerosene light, and the heat was by two wood stoves. So I've known poverty in my life. In 42 years, my father worked himself up from $400 a year to $4,000 a year and put me through school. After I graduated from high school in Sioux City, Iowa, from Central High School, at the age of 17, my father thought I was too young to go away to school, and my father believed in the liberal arts, and so he demanded that I go to a little college called Morningside College in Sioux City, where I attended for 2 years from 1924 to 1926. And Morningside College, by the way, is a college that gave me my first honorary degree in a building that I had designed in Sioux City that they used for the graduation ceremonies. Well, the 2 years in liberal arts were a good thing for me because I was learning mathematics and learning something about the fundamentals of English and physics, chemistry. In 1926, I went on to Champaign, Illinois at the age of 29 to study architecture. I entered with a class of 154 in 1926 and graduated in 1930 with a Bachelor of Architecture with a class of 18. 18 of us finished out of the original class of 154. I think I was probably about the middle of the class. I went to Europe. 1930 was the second year of the Great Depression, and thinking that business was going to be better after it came back at the end of the summer, I took all the money I had. My mother gave me a couple hundred dollars that she had saved, and I went to Europe. Left Illinois early, got back into New York after Columbia University, just ready to start, and was interviewed in 125 offices in New York, not finding a job. And so my design professor from Illinois had moved from Illinois to Columbia during the summer when I was in Europe, and he brought five of the graduate students with him to teach. So he persuaded me to be the sixth one, offered me a scholarship at Columbia University. But the day he offered me a scholarship, I got a half-time job working downtown in New York at 40th and Park Avenue in the Architects Building. I worked on the approaches to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Washington, D.C. for a year, half time, going down on the subway Monday through Friday, getting to work down at 40th and Park Avenue at 8 o'clock in the morning, and leaving the office at noon and coming back and going to school at Columbia in the afternoon and evenings. And a year later, I finished the work for the Master of Architecture at Columbia. Mabel, come on in. This is Tom Kearney. I just finished at Columbia, and the job in the architect's office became full-time when I graduated from Columbia, but only it lasted for the end of the summer. At the end of the summer, I couldn't find work in New York. In fact, there were several hundred architects who said were selling apples on the street for a nickel apiece to try to eke out a living. And so I came back to live with my family in Sioux City. And the following spring, I took the state board examination in Des Moines, Iowa, to pass the examination, and got a little work. And I was practicing architecture for about 4.5 years. I did one building in Sioux City, a music pavilion that the symphony orchestra and the municipal band used for concerts in the summertime. And Morningside College uses that for the commencement exercise. That's where I attended when they gave me a Doctor of Design degree. That came in 1967. Well, I began to look, the Depression was going to last for longer than I anticipated. I wasn't getting enough work. I'd met a young woman in the library that I later married, and not making enough money to marry her. She was getting $125 a month in the library at the time. That was a little more than I was making. So some of my friends had gone to Washington and were working in some of the bureaucracies there. So I went into Washington and found a job that paid me a rather spectacular salary of $3,200 in those days. It seemed like an awful lot of money. And working for the Resettlement Administration, I was designing buildings for the Resettlement Administration. They regionalized after I was there for a short time and gave me the choice of moving to Amarillo, Texas, or Birmingham, Alabama. And I took the larger city and moved to Birmingham. And while down there, I took a position in the leading architect's office in Birmingham as a designer for them. And had probably as precarious a time as any during my career financially. We decided to get married anyway. And we were married in January 5, 1937. I went back to Iowa for the wedding, brought her back to Birmingham with me. The following summer, I'd written to most of the architectural schools in the United States. I was interested in teaching. I taught at Morningside College part-time at a very low salary, just a sort of a token salary, and I liked it, and I thought I'd like to teach, and the head of the school at Norman, Oklahoma, responded to my letter long after I'd written it, and it was in the summer of 1937 that he asked me if I was interested in being a candidate for a position he had open at Norman. Assistant professor is going to pay me $2,500 for 9 months. And I didn't go out there. They didn't have the money to pay people to go for interviews at that time. And we decided he offered me the position through the mail. And I quit work in Birmingham during the summer of 37. And we took a trip through the south down into Florida, went on up to Norman, found a place to live. And I was there for 2 years as an assistant professor, and they liked what I was doing. In the second year, they raised my salary from $2,500 to $2,700 and made me an associate professor. And a year later, they raised me to $2,900 and made me a full professor. I was a full professor there for $2,900. I was doing some practice, and I did a house out there, which is still standing. And the house got a great deal of publicity. Before I built the house, though, I got a good deal of publicity on the music pavilion that I did in Sioux City. The fact is, in the winter of 1936, the Royal Institute of British Architects selected it as one of the 100 best buildings done in the United States between the two world wars. And I had large photographs made of the building and mounted them, and it was on exhibition in the Royal Institute of British Architects headquarters in London for a long time, and then the exhibition came to the National Galleries in Washington. So I got considerable amount of publicity on that, and then I had some practice of nothing of anything to give me any prominence in architecture while I was teaching in Norman, but I built a house that was considered a good house and was published in a number of magazines. California Arts and Architecture said it was one of the best houses built in the Southeast during the decade. The head of classical languages in Norman, Oklahoma owns a house now, and in the visit we just took out there in March, we visited the house and we were very pleased with the way they had kept it up. Fact is, 3-4 years ago, we had a telephone call one night, and there was this man, his name Nolan, head of classical languages at Norman, and he said, my wife and I were having dinner last night, and while we were eating dinner, my wife said, you know what tomorrow is? And he said, no. And she says, tomorrow we will have lived in this house for 25 years. And he said, well, I'm going to call Camp Effner tomorrow. And so he called me up, and I took his telephone call, and he said, identified himself. And he said, we live in the Camp Effner house in Norman. He says, the house is still called the Camp Effner house. Mm-hmm. Even though we've been living in it, there were the third people that lived in the house. The other two people lived in it for a short time. But he says, my wife and I wanted to call you tonight and tell you how much you've contributed to the quality of our lives during the last 25 years. It's about as nice a thing that can happen to an architect, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a whole lot better having them call you after 25 years than after they lived in it for a week, which they may be in a different state of euphoria at that time. Well, I came over here. I got my first letter from Sandy Campbell, who was chairman of the search committee, in October 1947. And I flew over here and spent several days here interviewing a lot of people. And then they narrowed the thing down to three people, and they had the three of us back again. And they finally decided to offer the position to me. And I came back another time. And then I went back and I wrote that letter, that 3.5-page letter, stating 17 conditions under which I'd take the position. And one of them was that they were going to get rid of 11 faculty members out of 15 that they had and let me bring in a new faculty. They were going to give me four new positions. One of those, of course, was Novitsky. And so I came, well, first I should tell you that I waited for about a month after I sent that long letter in to Harrelson, and finally I got a telephone call one day in Harrelson, and I expected when I got it that he was going to say, well, we thought about it, and we can go along with you with condition number 1, 3, 7, 8, 9, 11, 13, and 17, or something like that. That's just picking at some numbers at random, but I certainly didn't think I was going to get it under my terms. Harrelson says, well, we've been talking about it for a month now, and we decide the only way to offer you the position is on your terms. And so I said, oh, I accept the position. They started me out at $9,000. I'd worked myself up at Norman, Oklahoma, to $4,600 from 29 as a full professor to $4,600 in 11 years. Well, I was a full professor for 8 years, from 29 to 4,600, and they paid me $9,000 to start me here. And so I came on over, and we left early. We got here on the 19th of May, and they let me finish up my teaching out there about a week early. And I had some grading to do here after I got back and finished up and satisfied my obligation out there. And I brought four of my colleagues who were teaching with me at Oklahoma with me.
Dean, may I ask a question at this point? Is there any indication that Frank Graham had anything to do with your selection or played any part in it?
He was for my selection, but Billy Carmichael was against it.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I asked this is Dr. Graham was apparently fairly much involved in what was going on at State at this time and had some interest in selecting outstanding deans. I know he helped select Dean Baver and Dean Lampe.
Yeah, and he helped select me. But Billy Carmichael said that I was dynamite, and Billy didn't hesitate in letting me know that after I got here too. Billy gave me a hard time every once in a while.
Okay, but that's one question I have that I thought I'd like to interpose. Okay.
Well, stop me anytime.
Yeah. Okay.
You can interrupt me for clarification anytime. So I brought four of my best faculty members from Oklahoma with me, and when we decided to leave, the five of us, 125 students from out there wanted to come with us. And I told Harrelson that we 125 students wanted to come, and he says, we just can't do it. He says, I don't think we can let you bring any, because we got the trustees have cut off out-of-state enrollment. So Harrelson took it up with the trustees, and they said, well, you'll have to go through the 125, and we can let you bring 18. So we took the best. You see, there was a program here already, but it was a poor program. Mm-hmm. But we brought the stars that we had from out there. We brought three fifth-year students. They were marvelous students. We brought four fourth-year students, and maybe three or four third-year students, and the rest were second-year students. So we had the nucleus of marvelous students to plant into the students who are already here. That's why we got helped us to get going in a hurry. We established a reputation rather quickly. And then I brought Nowitzki in, Nowitzki was already prominent. He had been brought to the United States as one of the 15 members of the team that designed the UN. Oscar Niemeyer of Brazil was mainly responsible for the tall building, secretariat, and Nowitzki was mainly responsible for the assembly building. That's where you see the big group, the General Assembly. And then I brought Mumford down. Mumford came in for 2 years. He came here for 4 years, but the first 2 years he came in every 6 weeks for 10 days. And I thought getting Mumford here was so important that I shouldn't keep him entirely for Raleigh. And so I went over and talked to Frank Graham about him, and Frank Graham, of course, knew Mumford and knew who he was. And I said, I'd like to share him with the other two institutions at the Consolidated University. And so he spent a week here in his 10 days, and we took him over to Chapel Hill, where he spent two more days, and then they took him to Greensboro, where he spent the final day, and then he took the train back up to New York.
Was it difficult to get him?
Well, we paid him $6,000, and that was a hell of a lot of money in those days. You see, that was what we were paying. We paid Nowitzki $6,000 to spend full time here. We paid Mumford $6,000 for what he did, and Mumford thought it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. So, in effect, you took a faculty position salary.
And gave it to Mumford.
Okay, yeah. that was what I suspected, but I wanted to confirm that. Okay.
And then pretty soon I enlarged that position. By the time I left, we had about $18,000 in bringing prominent people in. That's how we brought Frank Lloyd Wright here. You see, Frank Lloyd Wright was here for 3 or 4 days. I can show you the bed where he slept in the other room. He stayed with us during that time. We had practically all the prominent architects in the world here at one time or another. We had Bucky Fuller here for 7 years, 1 month each year for 7 years. It's amazing what he could do, the social contact and the academic contact that he had with the faculty and the students during that time. It was a marvelous experience for the students and the faculty during that period. So by the time I retired, I'd built that thing up, that fund up to $18,000, and we used that to bring in world figures in architecture and design. Now, one of the, I've already told you, but not on tape, that one of the things that began to bring its prominence early was the magazine. And Jim Brandt, who was one of the very fine students who was already here, was in Novitsky's class, and when Novitsky died, Brandt decided that he wanted to do a memorial edition of his work, and so that was a volume one, number one of the student publications of the School of Design. And it had wide circulation, world circulation. And the students decided they had to keep it up. And so it was kept up, and I think 21 issues, 21 or 23, 22, 21, 22, 23 issues came out while I was dean, and I think two or three have come out since I retired. So that got to be in magazines and architectural schools all over the world. I recall going into the School of Architecture in Helsinki in Finland and telling the librarian who I was, and she said, come over here. And she picks me over, she shows me the list of the shelf of student publications of the School of Design. She knew who I was right away from the school, from the student publication. Well, the first big acknowledgement that we were getting recognized came, I think it was in about the, I think it was in the fourth year of the school. It could have been the fifth. You can probably find that in the clippings there, the exact time. It was in the fourth or fifth year. The Museum of Modern Art decided to have an exhibition of what was going on in the schools of architecture in the United States. And they picked six, the most prominent, who they thought were the most prominent six schools in the United States. And they picked us as one of the six schools. You see, this is pretty early. It might have been the fourth year, maybe it was the fifth year. I don't think it was as late as the sixth year. Mm-hmm. So we prepared our show. And it went up to New York, and it was exhibited in one of the prominent galleries in New York with the other five schools that were picked. The other five schools are probably in the clippings too. And that started a rash of out-of-state applications. And 2 years later, which made it either in the fifth or sixth or seventh year, the American Institute of Architects National Office in Washington decided to prepare an exhibition of the work done by the schools of architecture in the United States. And they picked seven schools this time to prepare an exhibition, a comprehensive exhibition of what the school was doing, to be exhibited in the capitals of Europe. So we became one of the seven schools. And the exhibition was so well received in Europe that it came back to Washington, and the next year it was sent to the capitals of South America, where it was exhibited in museums in the capitals of the South American countries. Well, that began to give us a kind of prominence that we came along pretty early. By this time, Harrelson had retired, and Kerry Boston was chancellor. And I remember Kerry talking to me so many times about how we'd done it so fast. And know, I gave you some clues on how we done it so fast. We, there was the American Education Association decided to rate professional schools about that time, and I think we got rated a fourth or fifth around there. And then the National Education Standards Commission, you familiar with that? Called the Gorman Report?
No, I'm not. Okay.
Well, this is a part of the Gorman Report that sent to me by the University of Oklahoma when they invited me out there. They sent that out to the alumni because they were on both lists, both undergraduate and graduate. But the first Gorman Report came out, we were about fifth or sixth. They published it every 3 years. And then in 1974, 2 years after I'd retired, we slipped down to 10th in the Gorman Report. It's in the library. You can get it in the reference. You can take that with you, though, because of your nature of count. In 1977, the Gorman Report comes out, and there's 23 schools in numerical order according to the rating. People had rated the deans and department heads, rated other schools, rated them from 5 down to 1. And the schools that rated from 4.1 to 4.9 were listed in numerical order in the 23 schools. Then there were something like 12 schools, you find this over in the library in the 1977 report. There were 10 or 12 schools that were rated from 3.5 to 4 in alphabetical order. And then there were 15 schools rated from 3 to 3.5, which really be from 60% to 60% to 70%. We were in that 15. We dropped all the way down there by 1977. Now another one came out in 1980. And that's over in the library too, in the reference library. But you'll find the ratings for medicine. WRAL did a little 3-minute spot on the rating of the medical school. I think the medical school is rated 5th in the country, and the public health over there 9th in the country. WRAL did a little spot on that to brag about how good the medical school is from this Gorman Report.
Mm-hmm.
Duke Law School is in the top group, in a distinguished group. Departments here are rated. You'll find electrical engineering rated, I don't know where they are, 27th or something like that, of 200 or 300 schools maybe. Botany is, I think, the highest, 9th, I believe, at state. Architecture and landscape architecture are not listed now in the 1980 report. Now, I understand people go around to McKinney and want to know why they aren't in there. And McKinney says, well, that thing doesn't mean anything. It's like the football teams and the basketball teams are being ranked. So you can downplay it if you want to. I mean, he can downplay it if he wants to. I don't know how much it means. I know that, let me see that thing. You got that list, or you put it up here. The dean at Harvard was here to give a lecture, and he hadn't seen this. And I showed it to him, and he said, oh my God, he says, could you get me a copy of that? And I said, well, you probably got it in the library at Harvard, but I'll send you a photocopy. He says, I want to take it and show it to my president at Harvard. But you see, if you aren't on it, well, it doesn't mean a damn thing. But if you're on it, you show it to the president.
Right, yeah. Right. That's how that if you're, the ratings mean something if you're rated.
If you aren't rated, it doesn't mean a damn thing.
If I could ask a couple of questions here, some things that I had taken note of from the clippings. one of them was something that I think got you some publicity. I don't know what the worth of it was, but here in North Carolina was the public school project.